to Roots and Branches on VOA Music Mix. I'm Catherine Cole in Washington. I am very happy to have one of the newest members of the Nashville Songwriters Hall of Fame in the Roots studio today. It's so new, Gretchen Peters has not even been given her plaque yet, but word came down last week that she's going in during the group's 44th anniversary dinner and induction ceremony this fall. Gretchen's written hits for George Strait, Trisha Yearwood, Faith Hill, and many others, including Martina McBride's smash hit Independence Day. She's also released 8 albums of her own. Another is on the way in the new year. And I am thrilled that she is here with Barry Walsh today. Give us a song to get things started today, Gretchen.
Haven't done as well as I thought I would. I'm not dead, but I'm damaged goods. And it's getting late. I'm a rusty hinge, a squeaky wheel at the bad end of a shaky deal. Cursed by the hand of fate. And ticking clock, a losing bet. I'm a girl without a safety net. I'm a cause for some concern. You don't live this long without regrets. Telephone calls you don't want to get. Stones you'd rather leave unturned. Sand becomes the pearl. Yeah, ooh, oh, oh. Hello, cruel world. Some folks go the easy route, numb the pain or put the lights out. Either way, they got to go. But me, I'm gonna stick around, in for a penny, in for a pound. 'Cause I hate to miss the show.
Welcome back, Gretchen Peters and Barry Walsh.
Thank you. Yes, hello. This is Barry Walsh over here on the
good to
keyboard.
Be here. Good to see you again.
Yes, very good to see you again. That's one that last time you were here, that album had not been released yet, right?
That's right. I think it was just before we were making the record
right.
when we came.
We always seem to catch you mid-cycle.
Well, that's fine. That's good. Nobody else wants to talk to me mid-cycle.
Aw, that's not true. That's not true. So goodbye, cruel world. Hello, cruel world.
Hello, cruel world.
Hello, yeah. Cruel world. You are, as I said, mid-cycle. That record's been out for a little while. You've mm-hmm. got another one in the works. Touring the U.S. now a little bit?
Well, we toured so heavily for 2 years after that record came out. I mean, frankly, I thought it would probably be about a year of touring, and the record just did very, very yeah. well. And we just kept on going, you know, sort of stood up and looked around, and it was 2 years later.
Surprise.
And, yeah, exactly. And I hadn't really, you know, I find it really difficult to write on the road. I can sort of collect ideas and gestate things a little bit, but I can't really write. So it had been a couple of years since I'd really sat down and done a good stint of writing. And I sort of put the brakes on at the beginning of this year and just said, I've got to work on a new album. I've got to write some songs and stay home and live my life. And, you know, I didn't want to write all songs about being on the road.
I guess it's hard when you are on the road all the time to sit and see things. I mean, to actually experience
stuff.
There's
such completely different states of being, I think, is the problem. I mean, the state of that I need to be in to write is deeply quiet, I guess, and not a lot of motion. Because, like you say, it's about observing, really. Mm-hmm. And I think when you're on the road, first of all, you're moving constantly. You're always sort of just trying to take care of the day's needs. It's a very, in that sense, I sort of love it because the mundane things that we have to do day to day sort of disappear. And it's all about, you know, where are we playing? Where are we staying? Where are we eating? When do we get to play? When do we get to sleep? That kind of thing. But it's very much a state of putting yourself out there mm-hmm. instead of being reflective and taking things in. So it's a bit of a shift sort of emotionally and mentally, and there's a little whiplash that goes with changing gears that way.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because we think of you so often as a songwriter that when you're out being Gretchen Peters the performer, you're not being Gretchen Peters the songwriter. But then when you're home being Gretchen Peters the writer, you have to turn off being the performer, which must be difficult because...
Well, you know, the truth is, whatever the thing is that I'm doing, I miss the other one.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just kind of the way it is.
When you were first starting out as a writer, maybe even as a child, as a writer, did you think of yourself as a songwriter or were you just writing?
I didn't know there was such a thing, honestly. I mean, first of all, you know, the very first music that I heard as a little kid was the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
And the Beatles songs and their records were so elemental that it never occurred to me somebody wrote them.
I just thought
they were just kind of there, you know, like rocks and grass and sky, and you know, they were just elemental.
Mm-hmm.
And then I sort of got an inkling because my big sister brought home Bob Dylan records, and to me they were accessible as a person that played the guitar. I learned the guitar when I was 7, and you know, you could listen to a Bob Dylan record and go, I think I could do that. You know, I can, it's a voice and a guitar.
Mm-hmm.
But it really, the mechanics of actually writing a song didn't occur to me till I was in my teens that I could do that. Even though I was writing poetry and prose and every other kind of thing that you can, you know, do with language, and I was playing music, I didn't put the two together for a long, long time in terms of creating. Then when I did, of course, I fell completely in love with the song form because it's a wonderful, very concise, very small form. Like haiku, it's you have to be, there's an incredible economy of words that's necessary to write a song. I think also that the time frame, you know, the idea of sitting down to write a novel and not knowing what you're going to end up with for years, I'm not made of that stuff. I couldn't do that. But the song form is small, and for whatever reason, it really appealed to me, just the conciseness of it.
When did the light come on for you?
As far as writing?
Yeah, that you could do that.
I was in high school, and I was playing coffee houses, and I was playing, you know, Bonnie Raitt songs and Jackson Browne songs. Mm-hmm. And I think what happened was I saw other people throwing in an original song here and there at a club or something. And I thought, well, I bet I could do that. And I tried my first, you know, my hand at my first few songs, which were just imitations of songs. They weren't really very good. But the real light came on for me when I was 19 years old. And I went to a rock club in Denver, Colorado. I was living in Colorado with my mom. And I saw Dolly Parton, who I knew nothing about except that Emmylou Harris did her songs and loved her. So I thought, you know, and I loved Emmylou, so I thought, oh, I'm going to check out Dolly Parton. And as foreign as she was to me in some respects, you know, culturally, the way she looked, everything, she just destroyed me within 5 minutes with her songs. And I realized, I think, that night, what you really, really have to do to write a real song, which is dig. Mm-hmm. You know, it has to be, there has to be honesty and authenticity in it. And I went home that night and I wrote my first, what I consider serious, real song at 19. And I think I got it about songwriting then on a much deeper level.
And what happened when you played that song for people?
Well, it got people's attention. I mean, I think I was trying to, you know, I had a bar band and I was trying to play in these honky-tonks in Denver and Boulder. And when you do that, you're playing for dancers, basically. Mm-hmm. You're just trying to play music that they want to dance to. And I wasn't very good at that. I mean, I didn't have the power as a singer or really anything to be a great bar band. But when I would do my own songs all by myself without a band, people seemed to listen.
Mm.
That was the big eye opener was, wow, they're sort of being quiet and listening to me. So I think that was the encouragement that I needed to know that there was something that I was able to do, that I needed to go in that direction. I needed to work on that.
And then you were an overnight success from there.
No, not exactly.
Right? No?
No, not exactly. I guess I'm sort of a late bloomer, really. I didn't move to Nashville till I was in my late 20s. And I realized that, you know, there was Steve Earle and Nancy Griffith and people like that were making records there. And it seemed like that might be a niche for me. It might be a place that I could fit in. And I still got to town and I didn't really realize that there were people who literally per se sat in rooms and wrote mm-hmm. songs. I just wanted to be an artist. I mean, I just sort of modeled myself after all my favorite artists, Joni Mitchell, Paul Simon, who did all of it. But I guess I was smart enough when I got to Nashville to realize that I did need to at least prove that I could write. Otherwise, if I, God forbid, ended up getting a record deal, they'd make me sing whatever they wanted me to sing. You
right,
know? So
right.
I at least, you know, had that much knowledge. But I think I was actually kind of a bit of a late bloomer that way. I think I'm the sort of writer that was probably meant to have some living under my belt.
So how did the doors open in Nashville?
I met a lot of people, but I met a wonderful man who is sadly no longer with us, who became my first publisher. And he ran a little publishing company on Music Row that the Oak Ridge Boys owned. And I don't know how people like that do this, but he heard something, even though none of the songs I had written were anything he was even interested in, he still could hear that I was going to do something.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to write something that would be of value. And he took me on and paid me a very, very incredibly small, you know, monthly, but enough to get by, you know, a monthly draw. And I just started writing. And along the way, he really helped me sort of navigate the waters. I tried co-writing, which is just endemic in Nashville. Mm-hmm. And I was terrible at it. And I had a couple really sort of traumatic experiences right off the bat. And he took me aside and said, you don't have to do that. I love what you write all by yourself. He kind of gave me permission. Things like that. And just the encouragement that I needed and the guidance that I needed. And we started getting songs recorded. The first song that he got recorded for me was recorded by George Jones, which is a great way to start.
Right. That's the king.
Yeah, it was amazing. I couldn't believe it. You probably heard me scream for three counties, you know, when I found out. But
what was it like looking at that credit and seeing,
oh, it's
you
incredible.
Know, written by Gretchen Peters?
It's incredible. And the, you know, the other thing, the classic, you know, Nashville songwriter story, the first time, I mean, I think every songwriter says this, every time you hear your song on the radio for the first time, you're in the car for some reason, you're always in the car, you pull off to the side of the road and just listen and dig it. It was really amazing to hear my words in George Jones' voice. It was fantastic.
It must never get old.
No, I mean, I've been on both sides of the coin. You know, you can love a song and it's still not right for you.
Yeah.
Just because an artist hears a song and loves it, if they don't record it, there's a million reasons why. So I understand, like, how that process works, I think, better than perhaps some songwriters that don't make records. So I'm always really, really flattered by that. I mean, to this day, and I've been doing this for 25, 6 years now, to this day, it's a flattering thing when an artist covers your song. It means that they get it, first of all, and they're willing to, they may have to sing it for the rest of their career if it's successful.
Right. Whether they love it or just like it.
So you kind of have to love it, or you want to love it.
I mean, we've had Ray Wiley Hubbard in here talking about that. How
there is an example. Yeah. I mean, he pretty much has to sing that song. I feel lucky in that I can go out and do a show and I can play Independence Day if I want to. But the truth is, it's really more associated with Martina McBride than it is with me. So I have the option of, maybe if I don't feel like doing it one night, I don't have to.
Or you could sing a line or two and
Well, there's that, too. I haven't tried that, but that's a good approach, yeah.
I mean, you could actually just play the chorus, play the hook, and people would know. And, you know, that's it. Because, for those of you that haven't heard me laundry list all of Gretchen's accomplishments, she has written a number of hit songs for other people. One of them that I know you've heard has been Independence Day, that Martina McBride has sung so well. Give us some of the other titles.
People probably know The Secret of Life by Faith Hill. Bryan Adams and I have written a lot of songs together, but we wrote a bunch of the songs for an animated film called Spirit, The Stallion of the Cimarron, and we were nominated for a Golden Globe for the one song, the title song called Here I Am. George Strait, Neil Diamond, Etta James. I was very proud to have a song Etta James.
Yeah.
One of the greatest singers that ever walked the planet is in my book. And Bonnie Raitt also.
But you've also released a string of great albums yourself.
I've actually lost count. I think I may be making my 10th album now, but I'm actually not.
Wow,
sure.
That's quite an accomplishment.
My first record came out in 1996, so that's probably about right.
And then also a DVD.
We did a live DVD last year because we had such wonderful footage of all the shows and festivals and things that we had done. And that was a big project, but a lot of fun to put together. People had been, you know, asking for a DVD, and I just didn't want to do the sort of standard get into a club and set up some cameras and just record
a performance,
you know. So we did something a little bit different.
And then I guess 2/3 of the Wine, Women, and Song have been in here. We have to mention that as well.
Oh, yeah.
You have your little touring companions that you go out with once in a while.
I do a show with my girlfriends, Susie Bogus and Matresa Berg, and we call it Wine, Women, and Song. And it's there's some of each at any given show, and it is a pure singing delight for me. I think the first things that made me fall in love with music was singing harmony in my living room, singing Graham Nash's part on Crosby, Stills, and Nash records, and you know, just learning, and that was actually incredible school for harmony because their harmonies are so complex and wonderful. But I don't get to sing harmony very much, except if I'm guesting with somebody on a record or at their show. But singing with Matresa and Susie is just like a holiday for me in terms of being able to sing all the high harmonies that I love doing. And we're old friends, but we sort of discovered that we had a great blend kind of late into our friendship. We just kind of got together one night and started singing together. And we thought, God, we really sound pretty good. You know, we got a thing. So we did our first tour in the UK in 2007 and just have been doing it off and on when we can all schedule ourselves.
We've had himself sitting over there quietly. Would you like to tell us a little about your accompanist?
I would love
to. Maybe he can play a song?
Barry Walsh has a pretty amazing career. He started out on the road with Johnny Paycheck. He was Waylon Jennings' band leader. He's played with Roy Orbison, Alex Chilton of the Box Tops, Dottie West. I was with him when He played with Al Green in Al Green's church.
Oh, in Memphis. Yeah. I saw that too.
It was it was amazing. But I did a few years ago talk him into making some solo piano records because I knew, you know, I've been playing with Barry for 24 years. We've been married for four, but we've been playing together for a long time. And I knew what he, I heard what he did just in the living room, you know, and I said, you have to record that stuff.
I'll play a tune called Koblenz from the new album. Koblenz is a town in Germany that we played a few years ago, and I played it there the first time, didn't have a name for it, so promised them I'd name the song after him.
You can do that with instrumental songs.
That's right, Koblenz, yeah. But the idea was I sat down one day at the piano, and I thought, well, what if the film composer Philip Glass had joined the Allman Brothers? You know, I wonder what would have happened, and maybe it would be something like this.
Beautiful. Thank you very
much.
More music and conversation with Gretchen Peters and Barry Walsh is on the way. I'm Catherine Cole. This is Roots and Branches on the VOA Music Mix Network.
Thank you.
again from Washington. I'm Catherine Cole. This is Roots and Branches on VOA Music Mix. Gretchen Peters is my guest in the Roots studio today, and she has brought Barry Walsh with her. He's playing the keyboard, and we'll also get the accordion out of the box in just a little bit. After we recorded this, it was announced that Gretchen has been named to the Nashville Songwriters Hall of Fame. So congratulations, Gretchen. Before the break, she was talking a little bit about touring the UK. Gretchen goes over there at least twice a year for a couple of weeks at a time.
I do, because my biggest and first audience is there. And I'm not even really sure why that is. We sort of just took to each other early on. I went over in 1996. And I did what you do. You know, I started playing little pubs, really, 50-seaters. See, Barry started with me in, what was that, 2001. And some of the places I took him to, he wasn't quite sure
He's
about.
He's shaking his head, for those of you not watching.
We pulled up to that first place in Leicester. And I thought, well, yeah, I wonder if I can change my ticket and go home tomorrow.
Quite a come down for you.
But as I told him, and I proved right, I said, you watch. It'll be packed in there, and it'll be a wonderful show, and you'll have a great time. And we went from, you know, doing that to doing last year, our London show was at Queen Elizabeth Hall, and there were 1,000 people there.
And Glastonbury.
And we played Glastonbury Festival, too.
And some other prestigious, as they say, festivals over there. So you're much beloved.
They're wonderful music lovers. They love American music. Mm-hmm. They're very engaged audience. They know their stuff. You know, they know who's played on what records. They're just very, very engaged. And I am so grateful to them. It's really been, there are many times during the course of my performing career when that was all I had going on. So I'm indebted to them.
Well, as you will find from your email inbox after this airs, everybody listening here too loves American music and your songs. I think that you probably got the influx of emails the last time you were here.
I did,
as well. So let's have another song.
Okay, let's do. I'm going to do another song from Hello Cruel World that is going to feature Barry on accordion.
Oh, the accordion is coming out.
The listeners who can't see this.
This is a beautiful one.
Are missing the blingiest, shiniest, most
cheapest.
Bejeweled.
Yes. How many
cheap accordion you've ever seen?
How many accordions are in your collection? Your personal collection?
I think I'd only have three or four. Like
you're
that.
Down to just three or four.
You can't have just one. You know?
No.
He's a collector. I threw a rose to the matador, not sure who I was cheering for. My aim was true, my heart was full. I loved the fighter and the bull. I love like only a woman can, a very complicated man. I bound his wounds, I heard his cries, I gave him truth, I told him lies. His rage is made of many things. Faithless women, wedding rings, snakes and snails and alcohol, his daddy's fist thrown through the wall. Oh, but he's beautiful when he's in the ring. The devil howls, the angels sing. Sparks fly from his fingertips, the words like birds fly from his lips. Some man is lying in the dirt, some woman's crying that he's hurt. He's not alive without the thrill, without the dance, without the kill. The lights go down, the people roar, they're cheering on the matador, and they this is how the story goes. I knew it when I threw the rose. Show the woman in the second row. I watch them in their ancient dance, and I know I never stood a chance. 'Cause while other demons prance and clown, it's vanity that takes you down. I thought that I could be the one, but I'm just another hanger. Some man is bleeding in the dirt. Some woman's crying that she's hurt. But who are we without the thrill, without the dance, without the kill? And he is bull and matador, and I'm the mother and the whore. And this is how the story goes. I knew it when I threw the rose. I threw a rose to the matador, not sure who I was cheering for. My aim was true, my heart was full. I loved the fighter and the bull.
So tell us a little bit about that one. Where'd that come from?
I think it's a couple things. That song had a hold of me. I have this place where I love to go to write, especially most of the songs from that last album, in the panhandle of Florida. And I usually go down there, and I love it because it's sort of isolated and I can finish up songs without a lot of distraction. And I went down. Normally I come back with four or five things finished, you know, things that are in various states of doneness. I went down on one writing trip, and that song just grabbed me. I wrote one verse as soon as I got there, and it wouldn't let me go. And I only wrote the one thing over the course of 4 or 5 days. I just was sort of obsessed with it. That was a little worrisome to me because I was trying to write an album and trying to, you know, finish up a lot of songs. And I did a little demo of it down there, and I emailed it to Barry, and I said, "This is all I've come up with for the whole week. This is it." I didn't get an answer back for a while, which was terrifying. And then he emailed me back and he said, "I think that might be the best song you've ever written." And I thought, okay, the week was not wasted. I think I was really wanting to say something about what is going on internally for an artist. And in that sense, I think that I identify with the matador in that song. But on the other hand, there's definitely an element of it of sort of archetypes of the male and the female. And I think that that artist, that matador in that song, is definitely a male archetype. And I've been on the other side of that coin. So I was sort of interested in exploring sort of both things. I think that I've spent so much time around other artists, and especially male artists, and have noticed that it's a different experience for a man who's an artist. I think it's just a different experience for female artists than it is for men. So I wanted to explore sort of all of those issues, and that song was the result. And I felt like the matador was a great metaphor for art, because he's constantly wrestling with this sort of life force that you love and yet you want to conquer. You know, you want to ultimately have control over it, but you probably never will, which is, of course, the bull.
That's one that I always notice captivates people too when you play it. They just get kind of still.
when I had finished the song, I thought it's probably pretty inside. In other words, maybe there would be a handful of people that would really get this song and really like it. But I've been proven wrong. I mean, for one thing, I've found some people have a very emotional reaction to it. We played that song when we were making the album. Our friend Rodney Crowell came in to the studio to sing on another song, and we played it for him. And he was sitting on the floor listening, reading a lyric. And when the song got done, he looked up at me, and his face was completely covered with tears. Mm. You know, I told everybody, we can go home now because it's not going to get any better than this. You know, because he's definitely one of my biggest songwriting heroes. The fact that he had such an emotional reaction to it was really interesting to me and really gratifying, because I didn't know that it would affect people. It affected me that way, of course, but you just kind of never know.
Is that when you know you've done your job?
Absolutely.
Somebody told me the hardest day of the year is always the day that he plays a song, a new song for somebody.
Oh.
Is that true?
It's like dying a thousand deaths. Yeah, it's horrible. I hate it. I wish there were a way to bypass that process. And, you know, it doesn't get any easier. That's the thing is, I think when I was younger, I thought, well, when I really get a lot of experience under my belt and I really have a lot of confidence in myself as a writer and I feel like I really know what I'm doing, I won't have these feelings of, you know, inhibition and fear and all of that stuff about playing new songs. Not true. Not true. You feel just as naked and exposed on your 500th new song as you do on your first. And you know, I think the thing that gets harder when you get more successful is to find people that will be honest with you.
Mm.
And tell you, that's not your best, you know, and you need that.
Let's have another song,
okay.
Please.
I thought, while you're talking about new songs, we might as well do a new song.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. 1, 2, 3, 4.
There's a Bible on the table. There's a bottle on the shelf. There's a woman in the kitchen crying quietly to herself. Down the hallway in the bedroom, he can hear his children wail. When all you got is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Well, he came home from the desert with a medal on his chest, like a hero, like a champion, but he felt more like a guest. Now he sleeps with one eye open and he wakes up scared as hell, and all he's got is a hammer and everything looks like a nail. They show you and they show you how to kill, but they don't show you what to do with this hole that you can't fill. So you dwell in the darkness of your soul like Jonah in the belly of a whale, and all you got is a hammer and everything looks like a nail. Show you how to kill, but
looks like a nail.
So what's the name of that one, and how long do I have to wait till I can just have that on repeat?
When all you got is a hammer. I think this record's probably going to come out very early 2015, probably January.
That is like an instant classic, I think.
Thank you. There's for
and I noticed last night when you were playing it that people just sat up. And
I've played it about 3 times so far, and it's gotten a great response, which is emboldens me tremendously. Yeah, because like you said, it's always, you know, going out and playing new songs is always scary. But...
Well, by the second time the chorus came along, people were just like nodding and sort of mouthing along.
I love
you.
To
were
see
singing.
That.
The people behind me were singing. So,
well, that's,
you know,
that,
they were on
that.
Key, so that was okay. But I mean, then you know you've hooked them when they can do that.
It's great to see that. Yeah, absolutely.
So you may have a new anthem.
Well, I that would be wonderful. You know, I mean, that's the thing about writing. You do have to please yourself, but you don't create in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. I mean, you are ultimately taking songs out and playing them for people, and you're hopefully getting something back. So it's wonderful to see, to get that kind of reaction.
Now, was that a song that just sprang out fully formed, or was it one
I'd heard the phrase, and I thought that's just a wonderful phrase, and it's so evocative, and I took it through several permutations before I kind of came up with a storyline. But I just thought it was such a great metaphor for someone who's just unable to channel, doesn't know or have the resources to channel what they've got going on. They only have basically one reaction to, you know, in this case, in the case of a soldier, you know, stress, PTSD, mm-hmm. whatever it might be. But if you don't give people the tools to channel
to work
stuff
through.
Like that, then that's what happens. And I think, unfortunately, there are in the newspaper every day examples of that going on. That's our world. Right. So I think that's why the phrase captured me so much.
Well, it's a terrific song.
Thank you.
And I'll ask you to play it again. No, I won't, but I would. I mean, that's the type of song that, you know, you're listening through for the first time and you just can't get past because you keep hitting repeat.
It's a wonderful feeling when you write something. Like, they don't come along that often. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's have another song from you.
All right. We, last year when we were getting ready to go to the UK, speaking of the UK, right before we left, someone sent me a link to an article on Facebook, which was an interview with the actress Elizabeth McGovern, your listeners may know plays Lady Cora on Downton Abbey. And she has a band and writes songs, and this interview was about that, actually.
She's been doing that a long while, hasn't
she? She has. I think they've made their third album, so she's been doing it a while. I hadn't been aware of it until this link that someone sent me. I read the article, and they asked her what music she was listening to, what was her favorite music at the time, and she named this song of mine, which was lovely of her to do, and I was really surprised and very flattered, and so I tweeted to her on Twitter. And
As
one does. And I said, thank you for the mention. That was really wonderful. And we ended up emailing. Her band is called Sadie and the Hotheads. They ended up opening for us at our London show last year. Barry and I both played and sang on their latest record. And the best part was a couple days before our London show, Elizabeth invited us out and she gave us a tour of the Downton Abbey Castle. So our Christmas card was pretty fantastic.
You always have good Christmas cards,
but
that
was kind of like, how are we going to ever top this?
I'm still partial to the Eiffel Tower, but that's just...
But yeah, so that was a lot of fun. It was really fun getting to know her. And from that moment on, we, of course, have been introducing this as Lady Cora's favorite song. I've got 5 minutes to sneak a cigarette,
5 minutes to myself. Back behind the screen door of Andy's Luncheonette. And I ain't got time to worry about my health. My boss Andy says I smoke myself to death. Andy, he reminds me some of you. Back when you were Romeo and I was Juliet, West Texas, Capulet, and Montague. I don't think too much about you anymore. We weren't much more than kids. It was nearly 20 years ago I shut and locked that door. Now I've got 5 minutes, not much time. I come home from work and I pour a glass of wine. Sometimes it's 3 or 4 before I stop. And Jesse makes a sandwich if I sleep through supper time. And she leaves me on the couch to sleep it off. Jesse just turned 17, and she's wild as she can be. And there ain't nothing I can do. Last weekend she ran off to meet her boy in Tennessee. Just like I used to. And in 5 minutes, your whole life can change. Now Andy, he's good to me, and I can see it in his eyes. He'd love to take your place. But something deep inside me just withers up and dies to make love to him and only see your face. Somehow I've let myself go gently down the street. Example I have set between the working and the living and the ghosts that haunt my dreams. I've got 5 minutes and I'm gonna smoke this cigarette.
Lady Cora has pretty good taste, I have to say. It's one of my favorite songs, too.
Thank you.
And well, it's hard to pick, though, actually, because, you know, you've written some pretty fine ones.
Thank you.
And we have a new album to look forward to in, you know, not so far distant future.
No, it's going to fly by all that time.
And so then we'll see you out on tour again, crisscrossing the U.S., Canada, UK,
Definitely Europe, yep.
Yeah, maybe they'll get you in Australia this time.
I would love to come back to Australia. I love it there. And it's been a while. It's been 14 years since I've been, but
those
I don't
festivals
know if anybody will
you.
Remember me. But
oh, yes, yes, yes. And those festivals miss you, I'm sure. They've got that wonderful string that started in, I think, November through February.
Oh, yeah. It's a wonderful place. I love it.
Me too. So, me too. I'll come along and sell the merch.
I'm not so wild about that.
Everybody can find both of you online and find your CDs and find out information about what you're doing. And
absolutely. GretchenPeters.com and BarryWalshMusic.com.
Right.
All right. And I appreciate that you did not find the special effects hidden on the keyboard during the interview.
Oh, you mean this one?
But look, you don't have to wait a couple of years to come back. And you don't need a new record to come back. You can come back mid-cycle anytime. Well, or you can come back when you get the new record.
Well, I would love to do that and play some more new songs.
Oh, fabulous. Sure. Okay, then we'll look forward to you in 2015.
Sounds good.
Hooray. Well, I hope you enjoyed the program this week and my visit with Gretchen Peters and Barry Walsh. Congratulations again to Gretchen, just named to the Nashville Songwriters Hall of Fame. And I'll be glad to pass along your congratulations to her, too. The email address is roots@voa.gov. That is roots@voa.gov. I'm Catherine Cole. This is Roots and Branches on the VOA Music Mix Network. ¶¶